Welcome to Weekly Sedition, the show dedicated to dissent and alternative lifestyles. I'm Contra, your host this and every week, right here on 97.3 WRIR, your Richmond Independent Radio. This is the second of a two-part series covering the J-20 counter-inauguration of George Bush that took place this past Thursday. Today we'll hear audio reports from the streets of Washington, D.C. during one amazing day of resistance. Stay tuned. We arrived in Fairfax, Virginia around 10 p.m. on Wednesday, the evening before Bush's inauguration and counter-inauguration. There'd been activities going on in town for more than a week, but unfortunately our group of three couldn't make it any earlier, so we'd be heading out early in the morning for one day chock full of resistance to the Bush administration. When I say early, I mean that we got up at 4:15 a.m. on Thursday morning with less than 3 hours of sleep, praying that granola bars and coffee would carry us at least through the morning hours. The ground outside was still layered in patches of white snow, translucent ice, and a gray wintry slush that looked like the product of a filthy snow cone machine. First on our counter-inaugural agenda, get our bicycles to the nearest metro and transport them to DC's Union Station, where the critical mass bike ride would be starting at 7:30 a.m. As we purchased our metro day passes, a station employee came over to inform us that bicycles were banned from the metro system all day long. Security measures. We argued that the website had not contained this information at all, and after a minute or two of polite haggling, he agreed to allow us through. But I wondered how many riders wouldn't be able to make it due to this unpublicized policy. As it turned out, there'd be quite a few. We spent most of the 45-minute ride into the city in a tired but somehow anxious silence. We emerged from Union Station with our cycles at 7 o'clock, a full half hour before the critical mass bicycle ride through the city was to begin. We didn't see anyone at all. As it turned out, we were the first to arrive. I noted with some disconcertion the prisoner transit vehicle parked nearby. Soon cyclists began to appear and the front sidewalk of Union Station became a small hub of activity. The metro bicycle restrictions had made the crowd much smaller than I'd expected, though. The ride just before the Republican National Convention had involved 5,000 participants and resulted in more than 260 arrests. The number of riders here didn't approach either of those figures, but no one seemed to care. Spirits were high, despite the bitter cold, and I wandered the area to do a few interviews and take in the scene. How you doing?
Good morning, fine.
What's your name?
Bridget.
Hey, Bridget. Why are you out at critical mass today?
I wanted to do something today, and I do have work. I'm a teacher, but we had a two-hour delay for the weather, so I pulled up the counter-inaugural website this morning, and I just found out about the ride this morning, and a friend of mine had done a critical mass in San Francisco, and I thought it sounded awesome, and this is something I can do before going to work. I'm not happy about the election. Wasn't happy about the last one, so
right.
I think it should be very exciting to get together with a mob of people, and it seems like a powerful statement.
Thanks.
So.
Why are you out here, Critical Mass?
I feel it is critical to come together as a community, whether you're Democrat, Republican, or biker. I think the idea of politics really needs to be changed, and this is a critical way to do it. Whether you're doing something fun or whether you're doing something like going out and voting, which sometimes isn't always fun unless you have a beer or something like that. But this is a great way to get politically involved in a social way, in a very fun way, on your bike. I think there'll be a lot of people here that are bikers, a lot of bikers or activists, and I'm excited to meet those people.
Great, man. Thanks a lot. So what's your name, brother?
My name's Pat Kearney.
Pat Kearney, where are you from?
LaGrange, Indiana.
LaGrange, Indiana. What are you doing out here at Critical Mass?
Well, I heard about it on C-SPAN a couple of nights ago, and it sounded like something I'd be interested in attending. Love to ride bicycle, especially when it's got a good cause.
Make
a statement.
What statement are you trying to make?
Well, not everybody, I don't agree with many Bush policies. And since today's is his inauguration, I'd like to feel comfortable about being like part of the counter inauguration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
Good.
What's your name?
Jonathan Kroll.
Why are you out here for Critical Mass today?
Because I don't like George W. Bush. I want to get rid of that guy. We'll have to fight him for another 4 years.
Yeah. So you think riding the bikes are going to help?
I think showing up and letting people know that people care, that probably helps. So one more body at the protest.
Thanks a lot, man.
Sure. Good luck.
Many cyclists had decorated their bikes with signs. Some were specifically protesting the inauguration of Bush, such as, "Elect a madman, you get madness." Others touted the benefits of alternative forms of transportation. One particularly clever sign read, "Infinity miles to the gallon." By this time, I realized that I wasn't the only one with a camera. The gathering was turning into a small media event. C-SPAN and TV Tokyo were the only major networks covering the ride, but there were a dozen or so independent groups with DV cameras milling through the small crowd. The assembly was soon blocking the entire entrance to Union Station. Finally, at about 8 o'clock, the ride began. We circled the Christopher Columbus Monument once and headed into traffic. It didn't take long to realize that we were under police escort. At first, I thought I might be involved in conflict with law enforcement earlier in the day than I had anticipated. But it soon became clear that they were in fact just escorting us and even moderating traffic as we pedaled through busy intersections. Did we need their assistance? Of course not, but it was nice to be helped rather than harassed. Of course, we were followed by two of those aforementioned prisoner vehicles the entire time. The cyclists grew more and more excited as the ride progressed. Random yelps of excitement and chants of "bikes, not Bush" punctuated the otherwise boring sounds of traffic. The group cheered loudly every time we passed construction workers, pedestrians, and anyone else we could encourage with our presence. Given that 90% of Washington, D.C. did not vote for Bush, all of the responses to the ride were positive. Eventually, we started seeing other groups of protesters, and the energy level was again increased as the groups cheered for each other. After a brief stop at the J20 Convergence Center for coffee and hot chocolate, we started the second leg of the trip to the Dawn Rally in Malcolm X Park. By the time we arrived, the rally was well underway and we were greeted by songs of resistance and solidarity.
None of us are free.
An enormous portion of the park was taken up by hundreds of full-size coffin replicas, draped in either black sheets of mourning or American flags. For many of the people assembled there, the feelings inspired by these two very different sets of colors are now practically identical. There were thousands of protesters in attendance, many holding placards and homemade signs. There were expressions of regret, of encouragement, of outrage. Some I can't legally recount on FM radio, despite Powell's recent resignation from the FCC. Most stood listening to the speakers and the performers that the DC Anti-War Network had assembled for the rally.
We have a loud and clear message to the Bush administration. He does not have a mandate to continue this war in Iraq. And that despite the lies of the administration, despite the lies of the corporate media, immediately after the election, every poll has shown that the majority of people in this country say the war is a mistake and it is, quote, not worth fighting. So we will be building that sentiment starting today to make sure the people in this country and around the world understand that we will not accept the continued presence of 140,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, that we will be saying, support the troops by bringing them home. Yeah. Yes. That we will be saying no to the 14 permanent bases that the U.S. is building in Iraq. Yeah. That we will be saying that the Iraqi oil belongs to the Iraqi people. Yeah. And that we will be saying that the money we owe Iraq to rebuild their country will not go to U.S. corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel, but must go to the Iraqi people. And finally, I want to say that I have just returned from an amazing delegation of parents who lost their children as soldiers in this war in Iraq. And when they saw after the election the total destruction of the city of Fallujah, they said, we must do something to show the people of Iraq that we think that not only is this war unjust and immoral, but we think that their lives are every bit as precious as our lives. And we took with us $600,000 worth of humanitarian aid for the people of Fallujah. And the people who met us were crying, not because of the goods we brought, not because they would have a heater for their cold tent, not because they would have a blanket for their children, but because they had met Americans who cared about their lives. And this is the face of kindness and compassion towards the people of the world that we will be showing starting today and every day for the rest of our lives. Let's build our peace and justice movement. Thank you all for being here. Let's go.
The speeches focused primarily on foreign policy, linking social struggles from the past and the present to one concept that the Bush administration is well acquainted with: fear.
Fear of red savages led good people to stand by while genocide was committed against the first peoples of this continent. Fear of angry black men led good people to stand by through Jim Crow and segregation. Fear of a yellow peril led people to stand by and watch Japanese Americans led into internment camps. Fear of communism led good people to stand by while weapons of mass destruction were invented, developed, and disseminated around the world. Fear of sexual minorities has just elected a right-wing, Republican, authoritarian moron. And fear of Arabs and Muslims is leading good people in Israel and the United States to stand by while a 40-year occupation destroys Palestinian society. An occupation by a country that already controls 78% of historic Palestine in a racially exclusivist and militarist society. A country that has expanded settlements, checkpoints, military occupation, has destroyed homes, schools, medical centers, all in the name of driving Palestinians into ever smaller ghettos, now locked behind an apartheid wall, into Bantustans. With millions dying in Africa of preventable diseases, more money goes to fuel the Israeli occupation from this country than goes to Africa. And we have had enough of this.
While the speakers kept coming, small autonomous events took shape throughout the park. As an Iraqi war veteran lamented the millions of dollars being spent on the lavish inaugural celebration that could have gone to armoring troops, A single woman drew a crowd with a song condemning the war altogether. And then there was my home crowd, the anarchists. They stood with banners and the black and red syndicalist flags, bandanas pulled tight around their faces to trap the warmth of their breath, express solidarity, and retain some anonymity from local and federal law enforcement who frequently surveil them with video cameras. I decided to interview one of the group for some fair and balanced reporting.
All right, hey man, what's your name?
Jay.
Jay, why are you out here today?
I guess to try to oppose the largest imperialist event of the year when they elect our new ruler.
I know
they put him into office, you know?
I noticed your sign here says a no more president. So you're not just specifically protesting this inauguration, but you would be here regardless of who was going into office, is that right?
Definitely. If Kerry is here or Uno, whoever, it's a statement against authority and its capitalism and controls in our lives.
Could you, for people who aren't familiar with the principles of anarchy, can you give them a brief rundown? Like, what makes you different from these, you know, people out here who are wishing that Kerry had been elected into office rather than, you know, the other way around?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't really think we are different. I mean, I think we're all working class and we all should be in this together. I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about anarchism, but what it's really about is just, you know, working class control and real democracy. So I think we're all in this together. I mean, we just have different understandings of what we need to do.
Less than an hour before the dawn rally began their march towards the White House, the Protest Warriors showed up. Now, the Protest Warriors is actually a right-wing group whose mission is to provoke peace activists at rallies like this one. 13 members of the group suddenly appeared, carrying signs and chanting slogans to disrupt the proceedings in an action their website called Operation Hail to the Chief. The anarchists were not happy. The baker's dozen of well-dressed Republicans was soon surrounded by at least twice as many masked men and women demanding that they leave with loud chants and a healthy portion of profanity. A scuffle shortly ensued between the two groups. No one was injured, but the protest warriors had their signs stripped from them and torn to pieces. The black-clad anarchists were soon escorting the group out of the park, stopping near the street to sing a parting farewell to the outnumbered and far less intimidating clan of Bush supporters. The protest warriors had obviously been given the shaft today, but I briefly wondered who had really won this war, with 4 more years of the Bush regime now imminent. I didn't know it then, but there was one more battle yet to come today. It was time for the march. There were 3 contingents. The first was the largest, the Dawn March down 16th to the White House. The second, a smaller breakaway march to Lafayette Park, where people would lay down in the streets as if dead to illustrate the human cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I would be marching with a third contingent, the anti-authoritarian bloc. We would break away from the main march and meet up with them again at a different location, hoping to simultaneously express a uniqueness from and a solidarity with the other anti-war and anti-Bush groups. No one in our group wanted Kerry to win the election. He was just barely the lesser of two evils. The problem, for us, doesn't reside in the election of the worst of two candidates. It resides in an entire socioeconomic system that takes power from citizens and gives it to a tiny group of privileged individuals. A system that inherently values profit over people. A system that by its very nature perpetuates disempowerment, isolation, consumerism, hierarchical structures of authority, and so many other forms of abuse here and across the world. As Callie Lawson once quipped, a system that offers us 100 varieties of chocolate bars, but only one idea for social organization, always represented by a choice between two rich white men who are virtually identical in every way. And so our temporary separation from the rest of the demonstrators was not exclusivism. It was a visual representation of our belief that a vast majority of social ills in this world take their root far deeper than the person of George W. Bush. They take their root in those ideas and establish systems that allow one tiny group of men and their privileged investors to shape this entire planet for the rest of humanity. The result? War, occupation, oppression. This was the spirit in which we began our march. The Dawn March itself was huge. I have no idea how many people there were, but all anyone could see was a moving sea of people in coffins. As the anti-authoritarian bloc split off from the other contingents, I finally noticed how enormous it had become. I'd never personally seen this many anarchists together behind one banner, ever.
People's revolution!
What's the reaction?
Direct action! People's revolution!
We were now followed and flanked by at least a dozen officers on motorcycles, a half dozen squad cars, and a couple of prison transports thrown in for good measure. Suddenly, I noticed a syndicalist flag waving some distance up the street. I realized with awe, and with some measure of excitement, that we were about to converge with another large group of anarchist demonstrators. Once we'd reached the others, we stopped to wait for a few minutes. We'd arrived early, and the main march would need more time to arrive at the point where we would rejoin them. The police just waited behind us. A group of radical cheerleaders provided inspiration and entertainment for us during our downtime.
Shut up! Revolution! Shut up! Revolution! Enough is enough! We all must rise up!
The march began again, and the air was positively electric with energy. But we only made it a couple of blocks, and then we stood still. The police had blocked the intersection up ahead with their vehicles. There was a tense moment of decision. Would we rush the blockade? Suddenly, the front line sprinted through the front plaza of the building on our left. We were going around them, avoiding a confrontation. Their vehicles jumped in the direction we had now taken, but we'd moved quickly enough as a group to make it one street further. We turned right, back toward the main march. There was a row of officers waiting for us, but we didn't stop. I saw the banner in the front of the march bend in the middle to form a wedge, and then we collided with the police. I immediately pushed forward with my video camera in hand, only a few yards from the shoving match. One officer drew his club and started hacking at the banner while the others shoved as hard as they could against it. Finally, the banner broke and the front lines drew back to regroup. I was in front now, but off to the side to catch everything on film. An officer ordered me back with his club, but I insisted that I was only documenting.
Hey, kid, back down, back down.
I'm just standing here, man.
Back down, back down.
I'm videoing, look at this. Right, I'm just standing here.
Back down. Back down.
Police were now indiscriminately macing people. Cries for water rang out as someone tossed a traffic cone at one of the officers who was blinding demonstrators. The crowd was now stopped, but intensity was building. With a three count, the front lines picked up what was left of the banner and charged. I was instantly attacked. A potent chemical mixture of capsicum was shot directly into my left eye, and an extendable baton caught me behind the ear. My cornea was on fire, but I instinctively fought back as best I could with one hand against the onslaught. shoving one officer away from me and somehow holding my ground. Adrenaline does strange things to you sometimes. Somehow at this moment, with searing, bubbling liquid pouring down my face, it made me laugh.
I'm f***ing zappered ass, motherfucker, look! I'm still standing here!
The street was chaos. People were being attacked everywhere, struck with batons, maced, pushed to the ground. One officer picked up a piece of PVC pipe. I immediately called for a street medic who helped me to flush my eyes out with water as best I could. Police cars were now streaming into the blockaded street. The anti-authoritarian block was retreating. I wanted to yell for everyone to come back, to push through, to combat the violence with sheer numbers, but everything was happening too quickly. As I worked my way back to the main street, half blind, I passed a photographer being smashed against a car. He pulled his arms in to demonstrate that he wasn't resisting, allowing his body to smack the hood, then roll to the pavement. The guard on the lens of his camera snapped. The officer stood over him screaming and threatening, and I wanted to help. I wanted to smash that cop into the car in the same way he had just done to that kid, but at the same time I was saddened and frustrated by all of this. I didn't have a problem with this or any other officer out here. I'd never met any of them in my life, and here I was engaged in a street battle with them. Why had they attacked us? Why prevent us from rejoining the other marchers that were now only yards away, staring with mouths agape at this scene? Yes, police and military forces have, throughout history, always served state and capital before people, and there's never an excuse to use force against a non-threatening individual. But at the same time, I knew these cops believed that they were doing what was right. To them, they weren't attacking non-threatening citizens on a public street. They were following orders. You don't have to critically examine what you're doing if you don't decide what it is in the first place. I don't take issue with officers, not really. I take issue with the ideology that's molded most of them into identical foot soldiers. Just following orders, ma'am. For me, the police are just the most visible branch of a system so massive that it's hard to frame well. What I'm trying to get at is that I know, and I think it should be known, that to focus on the confrontation is to ignore the essence of the problem. But next confrontation, I'll have two hands free.